Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is The Two Matts for the week ending Friday, the 29th of March, a podcast that has seized power. What's that all about?
I'm not too sure, but I like the sound of it.
That's the
producer. Regime change podcast.
Okay, yeah. Okay, what did we talk about?
We talked about how long can it go on with the Tories, and is there anything? Are there any variables left that can
have they hit rock bottom?
That can diminish the or reduce the scale of the impending disaster.
And then we talked about Adrian Charles' penis.
We did, which one cannot talk too much, I think. But that was in the context of a broader discussion of political satire and the nature of jokes and how important irony is, and which, of course, is not unrelated to the parodic nature of our politics at the moment.
That's right. It's all based on a big piece that caused a bit of a stir by Will Self.
Excellent piece.
In the New European. So, fair enough. Let's crack on with it, shall we? This is The Two Matts, episode 38. Enjoy.
Enjoy.
So it gets better and better for the Tories, doesn't it?
I just wonder if there's any room for improvement. You know?
We've had this crazy.
It's a refrain now, but it's gallows humour because the truth is that it's funny, but it isn't. And as a good example of funny but not, that ad they did.
Insane.
This week about London. Well, should we ask producer Matt to give us a blast of it?
Yes, give us a blast of the Tory vision of London.
London, a city steeped in history. But tonight, its ancient streets bear witness to a different tale. A tale not of kings and queens, but of crime and desperation. It is a city now run by the Labour Party. Its police answer to them. It is a blueprint for how Labour intend to run the rest of the country, if you let them. In the depths of these narrow passageways tread squads of ULEZ enforcers dressed in black, faces covered with masks, terrorizing communities at the beck and call of their Labour mayor master, who's implemented attacks on driving, forcing people to stay inside or go underground. Gripped by the tendrils of rising crime, London citizens stay inside. The streets are quiet.
I mean, what the fuck were they thinking?
Well, that is the question.
Who is it aimed at?
So, first of all, why an American voiceover?
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like something that one of the Trump-adjacent campaigns would run about an American city.
Yeah.
Trying to...
Baltimore.
You know,
the city
run by black people, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
And it's not even true, any of it. The seized power line. I mean, here's a guy who has legitimately, fair and square, won two thumping victories, Sadiq Khan, as London mayor. I suspect he's poised to win a third on May the 2nd.
Yeah, easily, at a wrong
point. Against the very unimpressive Tory candidate, Susan Hall. And they're sort of presenting this dystopian Gotham, you know, who will be Batman kind of.
I mean, but if anyone hasn't seen it,
you are
not exaggerating.
No, I'm not.
It is almost like it's a satire. And we're going to come to satire.
We are going to talk about satire.
Second half of this show. So there's a sort of link. But it's like somebody said, let's just try and do it like a Marvel comic superhero setup.
Yes.
You know, and someone's going to swoop in, you know, Super Rishi, Super Sunak is going to fly in and solve all of this. But it bears no relation to London at all, does it?
No, it doesn't. So first of all, it's intrinsically rubbish and deranged. But the second thing that I do find very confusing, and I have no answer to other than the obvious, is that, you know, we're used to politics in this country being, in terms of message control anyway, if anything, too smooth.
Yeah.
You know, that it goes through focus groups and then it goes through layers of advisors and the equivalent of our colleague Alistair Campbell when he was working for New Labour, you know, whichever party's governing has to absolutely tick it off. And who ticked this off?
Yeah. Well, surely Sunak. It must have gone before Sunak.
You would have thought. But this looks to me like something done on an iPhone by a madman.
It's absolutely nuts. And if you haven't seen it, just Google it on YouTube. I'm sure most people have seen it.
But I think it has. I mean, the Tories had to repost it because it included some fake footage, which was actually from New York's Penn Station in 2017, which is, you know, we're getting desensitized to this. We must avoid it, which is, that's a major, major lie.
Because what the footage showed was people running in fear through a subway station.
Right.
So they're trying to portray London as this city under siege, you know.
Like out of a J.G. Ballard novel, you know.
And in case anyone's sitting there, not in London, listening to this podcast, it's not like that at all.
No.
In fact, I can't remember London sort of ever being a place to be scared of, but it's certainly not a place to be scared of right now.
I mean, look, you know, it has its crime problems as any big city in the world has, but it's. I don't think you could honestly say that this is a terrifying, crime-ridden city where people, what does it say? They're huddling in corridors or
it's
huddling.
It's like sort of like Jack the Ripper kind of
vision,
isn't
it? Yeah, I mean, it is a sort of crazy Hogarth meets Dickens kind of image.
Enough of that specific, but what does it mean? What does it signify?
It's important, A, because it shows yet again how decoupled from reality they are as a group. And that's quite a serious thing when you're talking about the governing party. Also, it steers us towards a big day in other than the general election this year, which is May the 2nd, when there's going to be 10 directly elected mayors voted for. There's going to be a nasty by-election for the Tories Blackpool South, which is where Scott Benton has stood down from. And that's they'll lose that because it's a small majority, 3,690. 107 local councils. And that is also bad news for the Tories because the 2,600 or so council seats up for grabs, they did quite well in 2021.
Right.
Because this was on the back of the vaccine boost. And do you remember it was the Hartlepool by-election? It was the moment, we now know from Tom Baldwin's book, that Keir Starmer thought he might have to quit.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
So, in other words, this was a relative high point
for
the Tories, which means that they will, all of the polling analysis suggests they could easily lose half of their seats, which leads us to, could it actually get worse?
Yes. Have they hit rock bottom?
And this was raised by Daniel Finkelstein, who's a Tory peer in The Times very, very lucidly, and he thinks it could. Mm. And I think Steve Richards is right.
Steve Richards has written a piece about whether or not they should roll the dice and get rid of Sunak. And what I love about Steve is he's got that big macro view of politics, you know. And I'll never forget the series he used to do on the BBC where he did, I think they were half-hour pen portraits of prime ministers.
Yeah.
And he does them, stood in front of the camera, without a script.
Yes.
And he talks coherently and lucidly and brilliantly, analytically, about these prime ministers. I hope they're still on the iPlayer. They're well worth watching.
They're brilliant.
And he does these shows called Rock and Roll Politics.
Also often. Very good.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. Anyway, Steve, writing in the new edition of The New European, coming out on Thursday, Thursday. I should know that, shouldn't I, being the editor-in-chief when the newspaper comes out. Anyway,
that's the price of being an artist.
Comes out on Thursday. Quotes an unnamed Tory insider saying, about whether it's time to dump Rishi Sunak or not. He said, if it's a choice between death and madness, there is definitely a case for madness. And saying that to dump Sunak at face value would seem madness. But then, so that set me thinking, you know, if you're condemned, as it seems the Tory party are, then maybe it is better to dump him now and to at least put in front of somebody, in front of the electorate, somebody who could, in a short period of time, try and do a PR blitz based on personal energy about how the Tories should be looked at as an alternative to what seems to be a clear Starmer government and all the negatives about Starmer. But the question is, of course, who have they got now
that
could represent that?
I mean, there's a first obstacle to this, which is it's not just madness, it's grotesque, which is you've got the 2019 majority that Boris Johnson won. And if Sunak was deposed and replaced by another Conservative Prime Minister, that would be the fourth Prime Minister
since that mandate.
Now, it is true that under our uncodified constitution, the King in Parliament is sovereign and the Prime Minister is whoever can command a majority in the House of Commons.
Yeah.
So there's nothing legally or constitutionally improper, but politically it is not only mad but grotesque.
Yeah.
And I think that the public, who are totally uninterested in the details of constitutional nicety but, you know, are penetratingly sane in these matters, would just think, what is going on? And that brings me on to the second point, which is the, in a way, the bigger one, which is who. And all the polling shows that the only one who even flickers on the dial is Penny Mordaunt.
Is that right? And is that why, do you think, the flurry of expectation around her came up last week?
Yeah, I mean, so Opinium, this is on Saturday, found that of the four most likely replacements for Sunak, Penny Mordaunt, James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, the former Home Secretary, and Kemi Badenoch, the Business and Trade Secretary, only Mordaunt would have any positive effect at all on the Tory vote. So if Sunak is leader, Starmer has a lead of 18 points.
Yeah.
And if Mordaunt is leader of the Tories, Starmer has a lead of 15 points.
Right.
So it's not...
But it's a marginal improvement.
Well, it's a marginal improvement.
Let me ask you the question then, because put to one side the grotesque nature of it, because frankly, I feel like we're already well into grotesque.
Grotesque land.
Yeah. So put that to one side. Put to one side the interests of the nation, because also I think they've put those to one side a long time ago.
Yes.
Think purely about the Conservative Party, right? And they are facing a genuine existential challenge.
They are.
Aren't they? They may get wiped out in the general election. The party may actually cease to exist in any sort of recognisable
sense. Anything is possible now.
If you're looking for a night watchman kind of character to, you know, you accept you're going to lose the general election, you're going to be in opposition for 5 years, you're looking for a character that will at least give you a foothold on an opportunity to rebuild. It's not Sunak, is it? It can't be Sunak.
No.
Because we know he has checked out, I think. He wants to get through this election, give himself a personal ledge to catapult himself forward into whatever comes after, probably in California.
Yes.
But the Conservative Party needs somebody to give them that base to rebuild.
Yes.
Now, so if it's not someone like Penny Mordaunt, isn't it going to be somebody like Nigel Farage who steps into that void?
It might be. I mean, the thing about Penny Mordaunt, whom I actually rather rate, apart from her views on Brexit, is that she has run twice for the leadership, not successfully. And I'm not sure, other than the fact that people were rather struck by her performance at the coronation, you know, in her
with
amazing
holding
of the sword and
the Poundland outfit.
the specially designed. No, it was very couture.
But it had exactly the same logo as Poundland.
That's right,
and the colour scheme.
I think, you know, a lot of people who didn't know who she was suddenly became aware who she was. But I don't see that person, any voter, saying, oh, now they've got Penny Mordaunt, I'm going to vote for them.
No.
Because I think that, irrespective of what merits she may have, the change would be seen as yet another symptom of the problem. Yeah. And part of the problem the Tories have, and this is a structural one, and they're going to have to deal with it in the years to come, is that one of the many bequests of Thatcher was a kind of Führerprinzip belief that leadership is the first and most important thing. And leadership is very important, and it's incredibly important in modern politics. But it's only important as a vehicle for what you are trying to do. And the problem is that no one is offering what you want to do that will improve their chances.
Yeah.
I mean, the right are saying we need to be nastier to immigrants and we need to cut taxes to 5% for everyone, and as they always do. Well, you know, that will simply shrink the number of people who vote Conservative, because it will be clear that they're in the grip of a cult if yeah. you don't think that already. I mean, I can't see, given that we're talking about May, let's say there's a coup, because quite often what happens is the following sequence is that and this happened with Theresa May, actually, which was there's a disaster. In her case, I think it was the European elections, was it? Or I can't remember the exact sequence. But then there's a leadership vote, which the incumbent survives.
Yes.
But that's only because of the ministerial payroll.
Yes.
It's very hard to get rid of a prime minister. And then the situation collapses a bit more.
Yeah.
And the prime minister finally resigns and you move on to, you know, a leadership contest. But the problem is that leadership contest, unless it was a coronation, could take us into August, September, you know.
And the first act would be to say, right, we're going to have a general election. It would have to be.
That is the only way of making it even slightly rational.
You see, that's where I think, if I was, I mean, obviously, I'd be probably amongst the last people the Tory party would look for advice. But if I was them and I was trying to think about the odds, their odds, given the sort of absolute morass of problems they face, I'd say to them, change Sunak. Sunak's not going to, there's no upside to having Sunak go into this election. I can't see what the percentage shot is for going into this election with Sunak, because you're going to lose really heavily. And then you're going to be afterwards scrambling for what are we? You're fucked then. You know, you are nowhere. But if you went into an election with a new face explicitly saying, we're going to elect a new leader, that new leader is going to call a general election immediately, we're going to have a six-week election campaign where we'll make a short, snappy case, because, frankly, we know the nation is bored beyond belief with politics in general, and they're sick to the back teeth of the way we've been carrying on. We get that.
Yeah.
We're going to call the election. We'll make our case. The country will decide. I think that six-week period of a fresh face with very clear messaging could be enough for them to save something, to salvage something from the wreckage.
Maybe. I mean, to me, it reads like just another chapter in 14 years of insanity, as the thing is now seen.
Yeah.
Because I think in people's minds, there was immediately after Brexit a sense of, oh, something has changed. You know, we're now in the Brexit era. And before that, we were in the sort of Cameron and era, you know. But actually, I think now there's just a sense of these madmen have been in charge since 2010 and they have to go. And I think that the idea, I mean, again, we're speculating here. It's a hypothesis by definition. But there's something, I think, slightly insulting to the voter in saying, OK, you hate us. You hate the cost of living crisis. You don't think our border control policy is serious, or you don't think it's nasty enough, one or the other. How about we change the lead singer?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
How insulting is that?
Yeah. But you know, don't you think, I'm totally with you about the broader picture, but just from their point of view.
We're talking about varieties of desperation, aren't we? The question is the desperate you're talking about slightly better than the desperate I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I think the more important point, I mean, if another prime minister is deposed, it's a big story. I think the bigger point is that, I mean, let's follow the logic and say, let's say Morden does become prime minister. Let's say the result is slightly less bad.
Mm.
I think it would be slightly less bad. This is a huge inflection point for the Tories.
Yeah.
And timing is very important. I mean, we're recording this on Thursday, and the Daily Mail splash is another kite flying exercise on summer election.
Yeah, is it? I missed that this morning.
In which, brilliantly, Sunak is quoted by via Tim Montgomery. So treat that, you know, as you will, as saying, but it is a very funny quote. Sunak is quoted as saying, "Am I not very good at this? Why isn't anything happening?" And I just imagine him with his, when he's looking over his baby's first red box from Hamleys, saying these words to whoever the disloyal colleague was that spun it to Tim Montgomery. It's tragic, isn't it?
It's desperate. I mean, Alistair Heath, the sort of wacko editor of the Sunday Telegraph,
the voice of reason,
wrote a piece last week or this week saying the Tories are toast. You know, they're toast.
Yes.
And the truth is that Sunak,
he's a communist.
He's got a huge brain. He's the smartest guy in the room, but he cannot do politics. And he said that speech that he made, that secure, you know, that weirdo speech at 6 o'clock on a Friday evening about the threat to the nation. Everyone's just completely ignored it.
Yes.
Scotland Yard ignored it.
Yes.
You know.
Well, I mean, understandably.
The guy is without purpose.
Well, he's actually a very old-fashioned guy. I mean, he is someone who comes from, it cannot be said often enough, this is an ex-chancellor who, when he was at the Treasury, had a portrait of Nigel Lawson behind his desk.
Yes.
And he is living, you know, he postures as this super modern Instagram guy.
Yeah.
But actually, he is living in the late 80s. And he thinks that because of his ability with spreadsheets and as an economist and history and working for venture capital and hedge funds and so on, that everyone will think he's brilliant. And I think there's now a fairly powerful body of evidence to suggest the contrary.
Do you know what? Brilliant people can be exceptionally thick as well, though, can't they? You know, and you look look at what he's... And this, by the way, for clarity, is where I stand. Right, once I remove myself from trying to empathise with their problems, they deserve everything they're going to get. And I'd sooner see Sunak absolutely battered in a general election because I think he deserves it. And for more evidence of why he deserves it, enter stage left, Jonathan Gullis.
Yeah.
For God's sake.
You've got to be joking,
you know,
right?
You create the major mess up with Lee Anderson, and then Lee Anderson stabs you in the back, storms off, makes you look like an idiot. Let's do it all over again with someone who's even thicker.
That was fun. Let's have that one again.
Did you see him posing up for his photo behind that empty bookcase? Was there ever a better metaphor?
I mean, it spoke volume. Sorry, that's terrible.
Did you work on that?
No, I mean, the horrible thing.
This is what you get.
The sad, pathetic truth is that it just popped into my head. I'm ashamed to admit.
Jonathan Gullis.
I don't think that there's any saving them now. And I think it's not just like 97, where they'd been in power for 18 years, too long. You know, the country wanted a change. It was sick of the abrasiveness of Thatcherism and post-Thatcherism. It wanted some social justice as well as economic competence. And they got it. There was a sort of glamour to New Labour, which, I mean, there really isn't with Starmer's Labour. But actually, oddly enough, I think that the turning point we're at is, in terms of what's happening in the world, is greater than it was in 97. I think 97 was a celebratory moment, which is we've squeezed all the lemon juice out of the lemons that are the Tories, right?
Yeah.
It's time for the country to enjoy itself a bit more and have a gentler approach to public policy. And here is this moderate Labour Prime Minister. Yeah. And off we went.
And, you know, we should reflect that on this podcast and in the newspaper.
Yes.
But we should be looking forward about, okay, you've got a new broom coming in and with a huge set of challenges. So, you know, what's the correct response to the challenges we face? How do you prioritise those challenges correctly? How do you be constructively positive about getting this nation on the better footing? Did you see the story, the survey at the beginning of this month, that we are second only to Uzbekistan in, I don't know what's going on in Uzbekistan, by the way, but obviously some pretty horrid shit.
Yes.
We're second only in terms of national morale being rock bottom.
Yes.
In a survey of like 200 countries.
No, it's extraordinary.
And we fell into a category, us and Uzbekistan fell into a category that was described as a nation enduring. And it just felt absolutely right. We're all enduring what's happening to
us. Which
is
ridiculous when you think that this is the fifth or sixth richest country in the world.
Incredible.
You know, with, I would like to think, better infrastructure than Uzbekistan. Perhaps that's not fair. But I think that it's good prime ministers and good governments always ask the right questions. And the questions that are facing the incoming government are humongously big. You know, we are at what I think is Derek Parfit, the philosopher, used to call a hinge of history. You know, and you and I have said often on the podcast, will someone allow the 21st century to start, please?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, part of the malaise is that there is such a mismatch between the governing paradigm and the questions that people are facing in their everyday lives around cost of living, around, you know, how do we implement good, fair climate change policies? You know, how do we make sure that the younger generation have jobs and houses? You know, how do we make the NHS work? How do we have social care since all of the, you know, the workers are no longer able to come here because of bloody Brexit? You know, what are we going to do about migration in the 21st century when there are going to be more and more refugees, but also a greater need for migrant labour, etc., 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 not to speak of AI and quantum computing and all that. The list of questions is vast, and this lot just don't have answers to it. And the public, without in any way being interested in policy wonkery, again, people are wiser than they're given credit for. They know that this lot are finished. So part of my worry is that the longer it drags on, the more damage and the more corrosion there is to an already desperately damaged public trust and belief in the ability of government and public service to make a difference.
Yeah. I mean, you and I are both old enough to have lived through a similar national mood where, you know, I'd categorise it as there's a sort of apathetic frustration.
Yes.
But that the trouble with that state of mind is that it can boil into anger quite
easily
as well.
Very much
with
so.
With real repercussions. Yes. You know, we've seen it happen.
But, you know, I mean, I assume you're referring to the late 70s?
Late 70s and more recently.
Yeah, no, okay. But, I mean, here's the difference is that, you know, famously, James Callaghan with Bernard Donoghue by his side in the car, I think they were driving around Parliament Square, said, you know, time and tide. There is a time sometimes when, I can't remember the precise quote, but it's, you know, the point being, Callaghan just recognised it was over.
Yeah.
The party was over. And I don't know whether Sunak has that level of insight and that level of... And also, I mean, Callaghan, a very sophisticated politician who understood the huge changes that Britain had undergone since the war and was still undergoing, and a new phase was being entered. And the Tories don't have many people, if any, who have that level of...
Intelligence,
long-term thinking, public spirit, altruism, you know. And that's... It's bad in itself.
Yeah.
You don't want people like that in charge of the country, but it's really bad when you're reaching the very, very end of an ancien regime. You know, this is the ancien regime.
And that does... I think you've just identified, for me anyway, what is peculiar about these times is that they are peculiar in their lack of kind of public altruism and their thought about the nation. They are like rats in a sack. You know, they are focused on survival, on whatever they can do, but it seems they are... They would be quite happy, as that video, just bring it back to that absolutely absurd video, to rubbish one of the greatest cities in this world just to try and scramble a
collateral
few
damage,
votes
you
on
know,
May the 2nd, you know.
Doesn't matter, because because they are now, if they have any form of identity and bond as a movement, it is in self-preservation, which is almost nothing when you're a political party in government.
Correct. Okay, well, thank you for that. I enjoyed that conversation. Thank you very much. Hope the listeners did. And we're going to come back with something
more laughter oriented.
One hopes so.
What could be more fun?
A bit of
Rishi
satire.
Sunak.
Although
would
I don't think any
more
satire
funny Rishi Sunak.
I think any satire can beat the government right now. But anyway, that's what we'll try to do in the second half. See you soon. This podcast is brought to you, as ever, by the New European Newspaper, and we've got a great offer for you. Do you like the New European Newspaper, Matt?
Well, I like working for it and I enjoy reading it. So it's a double thumbs up from me.
So you're already a subscriber. So this is
I actually am. Yeah.
This is of no interest to you because you'll feel like you're missing out. No, but it's a great offer.
I find it validating.
Okay. Well, listen, if you're not a subscriber, you really should be because you'll be supporting fantastic independent journalism that you'll actually enjoy getting posted through your letterbox every week. And as an exclusive offer for listeners of the Two Mats podcast, we've got free signed copies of James O'Brien's hardback book, which is a brilliant book, isn't it?
Great book. The book.
How They Broke Britain, and that's worth £20. And you can get that by subscribing for as little as £1 a week for all of our digital stuff. But if, like me, you love getting your hands on a physical newspaper every single week, you can get that delivered to your door for just an extra £1 a week, and that's a saving of around 80% on the cost of what you'd pay at the newsstand. So please do the right thing. Subscribe to The New European. Go to thenew.co.uk/2mats. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S. And tell them we sent you.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound. And you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So, Matt, Will Self.
Yes.
In this last, the special spring edition of The New European.
Storming piece of satire.
A long, long piece, which I love Will Self.
Me too.
And it's fair to say that he has his critics. You know, we quite often get, and we got a few letters from people saying, how dare he have a go at Have I Got News For You? You know, it's such a great show. And Will lays out the case.
Rather prove the point.
Mingled with, it should be said, a little bit of personal retribution of having been slighted on Just a Minute and so on. But makes the case about how can you call what is happening on Have I Got News For You and increasingly in Private Eye and other forums proper satire when they're so enmeshed within the establishment themselves these days?
Yes.
And I just thought it'd be interesting to talk about satire in general, you know.
I mean, I think there's so much that's good in that piece. I mean, one of the things about it is in itself a great piece of satire because it satirizes the institutions it seeks to mock brilliantly.
And it's still online, I should say, so if you want to read it online.
Really worth reading. And it also, as is always the case with Will, it locates itself firmly in the contemporary. So he talks about how fake news and conspiracy theories have made it harder to do satire. And another, you know, simple but brilliant point is that with things like the satirical programs that started with That Was the Week That Was and then went via, you know, Spitting Image, Not the 9 o'clock News, the various Chris Morris programs, etc. We've lost the age of appointment television.
Yeah.
So people don't gather around the telly to watch the satirical show. And that has, even in the lifetime of Have I Got News For You, that has drained it of some of its power. But he's right. I mean, it's become sort of an establishment phenomenon. Yeah. And where I think he's also right is that politicians have kind of gone into the satire business, self-satire business. You know, it's very interesting how prescient there were a number of stand-up comedians about Trump, Dave Chappelle, Jim Jefferies, Joe Rogan, and now Shane Gillis particularly, who said, what you've got to understand about this guy is he's more of a stand-up comedian than a businessman.
Yeah.
He's funny. A lot of Americans find him funny. And that creates a real problem because once people give up on politics as a sort of engine of change and serious reform and national mission and see it as a form of entertainment, which really has driven Trump, Javier Milei in Argentina, Bolsonaro in Brazil, Boris Johnson.
Well, for sure. We must talk more about Boris in particular.
That is a problem.
Yeah. Let's pick up on Boris for a second since you name-checked him. This is one of the accusations that's levelled, is that, have I got news for you specifically, Paul Merton and Ian Hislop specifically gave Boris Johnson an aura of the comedian, the slapstick guy, the lovable man, which helped him, enabled him into power. Do you buy that?
It was an element. I mean, I think that it's important to remember how ubiquitous he was for a while before he sort of was tamed to a limited extent by being a frontline politician. You know, he was editor of The Spectator.
Yeah.
He was a very prominent columnist and writer in The Telegraph. He broadcast a lot.
Yes.
And he was everywhere. So
And he was the mayor of London.
He was the mayor of London, which was a kind of, you know, he was the pearly king of Eton, wasn't he? Really.
Exactly.
And I've always thought, I mean, Hislop, I've seen rail very crossly against this accusation that Have I Got News for You is responsible for the Johnson terror. I don't think it's uniquely responsible, but certainly by giving him the host's chair.
Yeah,
it gave Johnson a new lease of life and a new role, because that was at the height of the show's success, wasn't it?
Yeah,
you know, everyone was watching it, and it kind of made him it burnished his Lord of Misrule, winking at the camera kind of role. You know, cheeky chap, I'm the trickster. You know, politics is ridiculous, isn't it? Let's have a laugh.
Yeah.
So to that extent, the show was complicit.
And Johnson's smart enough to play that to an absolute T, wasn't he? He played it beautifully,
The problem is, and you've made this point before, you know, is, but people watched and liked it. That's the problem, is in all these discussions of, you know, who was to blame for Johnson, who is to blame for Trump's return, we always look at the media and we look at shows, and rightly so, you know, absolutely rightly so. But we stop the analysis at the people who vote for them.
Yeah.
You know, but they liked Boris Johnson, you know, and in 2019, they gave him a thumping majority, which cannot just be explained by the unelectability of Jeremy Corbyn. It can't.
No, that's true.
And Trump, you know, he's back. You know, he may not win, but enough Americans, incredibly, still think that this man who faces 88 felony charges, has twice been impeached, you know, is trying to negotiate down the bond he's going to have to give in a civil case so he doesn't lose Trump Tower, you know, is the right man to become president in November.
Yeah.
You can say, yes, Fox News, yes, Daily Wire, yes, right-wing movements in the evangelical movements and so on. But in the end, there are a lot of voters who want him. And I think that in this new era that we're approaching, one of the hardest conversations that should have been had after 2016 but really wasn't, was, well, what does all this say about us? You know, we're progressives, we keep to our values, we want to hold fast them and we want to renew them in a new context, but where did we go wrong?
No, it's true. It's
progressives do not like answering that one. You know, a lot of them just respond, you know, with a blank stare and a data viz.
Yeah.
But clearly, we haven't nailed it at all.
Well, I'm just on a sort of even more base level, to your point about the fact is people liked what they saw. You know, it's like, I always remember, you know, we must give Private Eye, Ian Hislop's Private Eye, lots of credit.
Because
they brilliantly satirise and hit the nail on the head on their front covers and inside so often. But going back to when Diana died, the first cover I remember was the crowd scene of all the flowers outside Buckingham Palace, and there was a speech bubble coming out of somebody, a member of the public, and it said something like, I blame the tabloids, and another one saying something like, so do I, I've read all about it in The Sun, do you want a copy? You can have my copy if you want. You know, it's true, there is a sort of, there's a machine, there's a beast that's being fed.
Yes.
And media are very bad. One of the things that... that Will references is that great H.L. Mencken quote about what satire should be, and it's to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted.
Absolutely.
And we all like to think we live up to that, but I think the truth is that we don't afflict the comfortable as often as we should.
Let's flip it. Okay, talk about political satire, problems thereof, right? One of the problems that political satire has at the moment is that we do exist, and you know, people deny it, but it's true. We exist in a culture where, talk about role reversals, comedians are supposed to behave like politicians.
Yeah.
So comedians are supposed to behave with the sort of, you know, sanctimonious rectitude of people running for office.
Yeah.
So, you know, the most egregious example, and irrespective of the way you stand in the debate, it's horrific. The way that Graham Linehan has been, you know, the creator of Father Ted and many other great shows, has been destroyed for his views on gender politics. Now, this is a very fraught area and there are lots and lots of views. But it is literal insanity that we're at the Edinburgh Fringe last year, that, you know, which is supposed to be this great place of free thought and edgy comedy.
Yeah.
He had to change his venue twice.
Yeah.
Now, how can you expect political satire to thrive in an environment where comedians are supposed to behave themselves?
Well, so it all got a little bit close to home for me. It must have been about this time last year when Will Self, again, who can be a challenge as an editor because he puts in front of you uncomfortable content.
And he knows it.
And of course he does. And he put in front of me a piece about Adrian Childs, right?
But Adrian Childs' specific...
And about Adrian Childs's. It was basically about Adrian Childs's urinal in his bathroom and the fact that Will was saying, why would you write about the fact that you had a urinal in your house unless you wanted everybody to think about your penis, right?
Yes.
And it went on for about 2,000 words. And it was just a wonderfully satirical hit on, you know, nepotism of Adrian's wife, Kath Viner, who's the editor of The Guardian, employing these pieces, blah, 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 blah. The whole bloody world went mad, you know, with outrage. And what I had read as obviously a very talkly written and challenging but funny as hell piece of satire. And Twitter went predictably nuts. I wasn't bothered about that. But what I was surprised at was when somebody who I thought should know better, who was a very experienced journalist and a member of our investors and, you know, and someone who I would say was a friend, wrote me an email saying this is utterly beyond the pale. It's not funny. It's, you know,
unimpressive. It was funny.
And what on earth were you thinking publishing it? And then went on to complain to board members and stuff like this. And I thought, oh, get a grip, man. It's piece of satire. And, you know, for one editor to write to another editor saying, how dare you publish this thing about a third editor? I thought it just spoke volumes about the lack of willing, when some, as Will Self says in this piece, when we afflicted the comfortable, i.e. ourselves, we weren't prepared to accept that.
No.
And there is a sort of broad clubbability within media
absolutely,
that needs challenging.
And also comedy generally, not just satire, has to be reckless.
Yeah.
Otherwise it's not funny.
Yeah.
You know, things that are funny are not necessarily true.
Do you know my favourite line in Curb Your Enthusiasm, right? The great Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's, I don't know which series it is, 6 or 7, something like this. Larry David's at a pool party in Hollywood and it's full of people stood around this pool having canapes and drinks. And it's a very pleasant evening. And there's a kid, the host's child, is messing around in the pool and is totally naked. It's a male child. And the child is very well endowed, right?
Mm.
And Larry David says to the child's father, the host of the party, points to the kid and says, hey, great penis.
What?
The guy
goes
stops.
Crazy, yeah.
Get out of my house.
Yeah.
Get out of my house. Right. Throws them out. Throws his wife out. The whole thing's ruined, right?
Yes.
And Jeff, Larry David's sidekick, walks as they're all being thrown out of the house.
Yes, yes.
Says, what the hell were you thinking? And David just looked at him and said, I took a risk. That to me is comedy. Every time you say something funny, you're taking a risk. And people have got to accept it in that spirit.
Yes, no, completely. I mean, you can't have a brittle spirit. You've got to be reckless and you've got to be ready to take a risk. And there are very few things actually in life that terrify me. and I genuinely mean terrify me. One of them is the slow decline of irony.
Yeah.
And the rise of the humourless. Because there's absolutely no doubt that, you know, I don't think the world is in total, I leave aside Brexit Britain, but, you know, I don't think everything is in total mortal decline, you know, and I'm optimistic about the future. But one of the things that really does make me feel very, very on edge is the fact that jokes are now so subject to literalist scrutiny.
Yeah.
And literalism is, you know, it is one of the things that always precedes authoritarianism. You know, literalism is an incredibly bad sign in a society.
Yeah.
Where when you say something to be funny, you are assumed to be speaking literally.
Yeah.
And that is undoubtedly something that is increasing.
And also, like, as Jay-Z said, if you don't like my words, hit fast forward. You know, it's like, you don't have to listen. You don't have to buy the paper. You don't have to watch the show. You can switch off. You don't have to implode.
And he's got 99 problems. And can I just say, just to counter to Will's on, so we can, you know, end on a slightly optimistic note, which is, I think he's right. But it's not all gone. So I think a lot of satire has migrated from these old, you know, institutional National Trust shows, as it were, to memes, social media clips. You know, I mean, there are still great. We all read Marina Hyde in The Guardian.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, she's the Jonathan Swift of our time, isn't she? She's brilliant, you know. But there's also people like Rosie Holt.
Yes.
Who have invented new forms of satire. And there's Matt Ford, Matt Chorley.
Stuart Lee.
John Stewart is back.
Yeah.
Jonathan Pye.
Yeah.
Tom
Brilliant.
Walker's. He's on tour at the moment.
Yeah.
You know. So I don't think it's dead.
No.
And one must always remember that one of the things about political satire is it's always dead.
Yeah.
So do you remember Tom Lehrer, the great political satirist singer, saying that political satire was dead when Henry Kissinger was given the Nobel Peace Prize, which was in itself a brilliant piece of political satire. And that was 1973.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're still doing it, you know. So I don't think it's dead. But I think Will's sort of warning in that kind of... He's a modern-day juvenile, you know. He's this kind of doom-filled voice, you know, you can read it. It's good. It was a good shot across the bows, that.
I remember, I mean, as every kid growing up probably has heard, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. But it seems like increasingly we live in an age where people believe that words will literally hurt them.
Well, I mean...
And they will if you allow them to.
I mean, on American campuses, words are violence is a slogan. And that's... I think that's wicked because... Mm. There is a lot of violence in the world, real violence. And, you know, words, however horrible, are not the same as a smashed head or a shot body, you know. And there's enough of that to worry about.
Or opportunities denied.
Or opportunities denied, you know.
Prejudice and all of that stuff.
Yeah, and by the way, this is... I'm not a free speech absolutist.
No,
you know,
no.
I believe firmly in the rule of the law and, you know, and not incitement to violence and all that stuff. But we have undoubtedly reached a point where we've lost our sense of the importance of wit and humour as integral to any healthy democracy.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And also just healthy, natural life.
Hence the covers of The New European.
I hope so.
If I may sort of bring us back to naked plug, you know.
Be my guest.
You know.
Well, in the last issue, we had that photo that... I mean, it was rather unfortunate timing because it was done like 6 days before Kate announced she had cancer.
But it was clearly it was at the expense of the Tories.
It was
not
at
her.
The expense. So what we did was we'd taken that photograph, which there was this huge furore about, and we stuck Rishi Sunak and Suella Braverman and Liz Truss and Lee Anderson, and we parodied that photograph.
Yeah.
But it was a joke at the Tories. But we've had people saying outrageous bad taste. The poor woman's got cancer. Well, she's not hurt by it. It was a joke about the Tories.
Yes.
It was the talk of the town at the time. What I would say to these people is, what are you so angry about? What is it that's driving you to the point where you're feeling the need to email in about the outrage?
Well, as the excellent American stand-up comedian Anthony Jeselnik says, whenever someone says something like that or complains on social media, don't forget that what they're really saying is, don't forget about me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
don't forget about me.
Well, you won't forget about us. And if you feel outraged and appalled...
Simple Minds said it first and best.
If you, what you've heard has outraged you and you haven't done the rational thing, which would be to just switch off and listen to, I don't know, the rest is
Miles
Politics
Davis.
Or Miles, yeah, whatever, anything else. If you haven't done that, then just write in, vent your fury. We'll read out the most vitriolic emails.
And
just
mock it studiously.
Mock you to the point where you wish you'd never bothered. And our address for feedback is 2Matts, that's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S, at tnepublishing.com. We love to get your emails, so please, happy or sad, please fire them in. Or, of course, if you listen on Spotify, you can send us abuse there as well. It's very easy. Jonathan Fogel messaged us on Spotify, said, I know this may grate against your adoration of Starmer. Yes, Jonathan's sending us abuse. That's good. I know this may grate against your adoration of Starmer, but has Mandelson's recent address left no doubt about the depths that Labour has descended into Brexitdom? What do you think? Are Labour deep into the world of Brexitdom?
No.
Okay. Well, we'll deal. I'm sure we will definitely. Thank you for that response.
Well, I mean, I could. You know, there's a sort of. That's the executive summary. Do you want an elevator pitch or not?
We'll do the whole. We'll do that topic in depth at some point in the future, probably. There is no Q&A on Easter Sunday, folks. So
Matt and I will be at church.
We'll be praying for your souls.
Dressed as the baby Jesus, each and all.
But we will be resurrected on the following Friday.
We will. And it came to pass.
Remember our subscription. We've lost all the Christians now as well.
Oh, no. Not our huge Christian demographic.
Remember our subscription offer. It's at theneweuropean.co.uk/2Matts. And there is a link in the show notes. And you get that wonderful James O'Brien book.
Yes.
Great reading if you're going away over Easter. Thank you, as ever, to our producer, Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, with support from Ollie Pearce. And until next week...
It's goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from him. Goodbye.
Goodbye.